Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is artist Nicholas Down. Down was born in Kampala, Uganda, spent his formative childhood in East Africa, and returned to the United Kingdom to study at King's College, Canterbury, and the London Hospital Medical College, where he both qualified with distinction as a doctor in 1980 and received an honorary Blue Medal for his work as director of the Art Society. Down retired from medicine in 2012 and emigrated to the United States to continue his work as a professional artist. His work has been exhibited extensively in solo and group shows, as well as in private collections all over the world. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tish. I'm very happy to be here.
Now, you have a fascinating career trajectory to me. What came first, your love for medicine or your love for art?
That's always been a tricky one. When I was 16, I fell in love with technical drawing at the King's School, Canterbury, and I used to draw the stained glass windows in the cathedral, and it had an enormous impact on me, the accuracy of drawing. So I began to study drawing and so on. And then, of course, with the necessities of A-level studies, I decided to study science, amongst which was chemistry, biology, and physics. And I asked my father about going to art school, and he said, I don't think you'll make a career. So I opted to go for medical school instead. But ever since the age of 16 or 17, I've been an artist at heart.
You never let it go, to pursue that.
Apart from, about 10 or 15 years when I was working as a doctor. Of course, having studied medicine, I became really, really fascinated by the need to be an observer of people. And the accuracy of my drawing studies fed into my work as a doctor.
Oh, that's interesting. I had never heard anybody make that correlation. Now, you say you were influenced by the artist Paul Klee.
Yes.
Tell us why.
I was absolutely bowled over when I first went to an exhibition of his work. I think it was on the South Bank at the festival at the Hayward Gallery. And I was intrigued by his kind of revolutionary storytelling in his imagery. And I then went on to study his work further. And I was, for a birthday, I think my 21st, I was given two great volumes of his writing about drawing and painting. And it became a kind of lexicon for me. Amongst many other ways of working was his effort to make the invisible visible.
Yeah, you actually quote him. Yes. Art does not reproduce the visible. Yeah. Rather, it makes visible.
The invisible, yes.
Yeah.
Which, of course, then ties in with the whole area of psychology and the unconscious, the world of dreams, and I was studying Carl Jung at the time. And I think there was a tremendous overlap between those emergent studies and my work as an emergent artist, too.
Now that you've had all this experience as an artist, what would you say is visible?
Well, okay, let's take... I mean, in 2007, I went to visit the west of America, the southwest, and I was completely flabbergasted by the beauty of the landscapes.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, you can take photographs, and I have taken many photographs, and I have also made film of that area. But there's something else that can be told as a story about that kind of experience of the landscape, which is really the way one's own self interacts with that landscape. And that is the invisible that I try to make visible in my paintings.
So putting your own emotions and your own personality.
And I don't try to...
And filling in the landscape in that way.
Yes. And I don't try in the paintings to say, look, here's a this or here's a that, but more to allow the viewer to impart their own selves into the paintings so they can change from time to time, from day to day, from mood to mood when they look at the paintings.
Yeah. While you were a practicing physician, were you always considering yourself more an artist?
Yes.
Or were they intertwined in such a way?
Well, they were kind of intertwined. I mean, I was also a writer, and I have, funnily enough, just finished my autobiography of my work as a doctor, and it's called Unclaimed Ashes. And it's really a reflection back on the art of medicine. So there is very much an overlap between the art of medicine and the art of art, as it were.
Yeah. You say that you recently started to study drawing more seriously. Is that true?
As a teenager. And then I picked it up again seriously in the early 1990s and did a lot of eye-hand coordination training, which involved using my right hand, I'm right-handed, my left hand, and also drawing upside down to really, really break that kind of fixated way we tend to have of seeing things. And it's amazing what you can do if you draw upside down.
I try to write, I'm right-handed, and I try to write with my left hand, and it makes my brain feel different.
It was on fire, doesn't it?
It does.
Yeah.
Now, I think it's very curious that you decided to give up medicine, come to the U.S. to pursue your art.
Yes.
Why the U.S.? There seem to be so many countries in Europe that are more artist-friendly.
Okay, when I was a teenager, I used to have dreams about kayaking in the lakes of northern Canada and America. I had dreams about going to New York. And as things turned out, I met and fell in love with my wife, who's from Manhattan. We met on an island in Scotland in 1998, after my first marriage had unfortunately fallen on the rocks. And as a consequence of that, we got married 2 years later in the Hudson Valley.
So you have ties here.
Yes, I do, very
absolute
much so.
Ties.
I consider America absolutely my home. I mean, I love the country. I love the scale of it. I think it reminds me of my childhood in Africa, the vast horizons, the colours. And I think there is still the opportunity factor in this country, the American dream, if you will. I've often asked people, what is the American dream? And they find it difficult to answer. But I think there is that incredible... I mean, nobody speaks of the German dream or the English dream, but there is the American dream.
Yeah.
I think there's something about this country which I just think is compelling.
Yeah, yeah. The American dream to me is a wonderful fantasy.
Yes. But it can propel people.
Of course it can. Yes, and it can. It can motivate one.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Now, you went from traditional landscapes to more abstract. What was the reason behind that?
I think the turning point came in 92 when I went to a weekend course at Brunel University in abstract art. I had been studying the American Abstract Expressionists in some detail, Martha Grothko and Pollock and so on, and being absolutely impressed by their work, and Barney Newman with his incredible lecture series about what he was on about. And I love the sense of cohesion in their dedication to what their vision was. And so at the time, I also then studied screen printing and etching. And the technique of screen printing involves a very fluid, kind of squeegee-like application of paint. And I had tried this once with some alkyd paints I was working with. And suddenly things began to gel in a way that I'd never had before. Then I used to visit the northwest of Scotland year after year and spend a lot of time up there photographing and drawing the landscape. And there's something about that light, the very northern Scottish light, which is compelling in the way that it dissolves in front of your eyes. I then began to evolve this dissolving, squeegee-like, fluid approach to the paintings, and that began the process of the new works then. The early works were kind of very oceanic, very aquascape-ish, and then they began to evolve more and more. Conversely, at the same time, I was also experimenting more with what I call the biomorphic abstraction, which are the storytelling works inspired by Paul Klee and so on. And that's a whole other journey altogether.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I always have thought traditional landscapes reveal too much, and I prefer the mystery of being able to look at somebody's work and project my own thoughts into
absolutely.
It. Is that one of the reasons why you wanted to do? You want to keep the mystery more
yes,
so?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
I once had a delightful person come into one of my gallery shows, way in the very first show, in fact. And I had these sort of aquascapes there, and he said, "I like the colours." He said, "I like the colours, but could you put some seagulls in for perspective?"
Oh, my goodness. Oh, Lord.
I said, no.
You were polite about it, right?
Yeah.
I bet you get that often, though, because there are still so many people who want traditional landscapes for their homes.
And absolutely right. I mean, there's a whole world for traditional landscape painters, and I admire them. Of course, my own studies way back go to Turner and Constable and, of course, the Impressionists.
Yeah.
And, of course, they were an amazing sense of inspiration for what I do.
Yeah, yeah.
But for me personally, I think it's the mysterious, abstracted nature of what I do that really is the way I want to go.
Yeah.
And this last 8 months, I've painted probably about 25 paintings using a texture medium underneath the paint, which then allows me to go into other ways of telling a story.
Yeah, and you know, when I visit, I lived in Amsterdam for a while and went to the Van Gogh Museum and all those museums with all the Impressionists. I couldn't believe how different it looks in person. It is almost mysterious not.
It is. Well, if you look
quite
at the Monet,
as traditional,
the Lily paintings of Monet, I mean, up close and personal, they are totally abstract.
Yeah.
And the thick impasto that he gets is just, I mean, oh boy, that's incredible.
So I can understand why one would want to dance between the two and maybe find a whole new way of looking.
Yes.
Now, you paint almost exclusively in oils.
Yes.
Do you make your own oils? Do you make your own colors?
Some years ago, I think in 2006, my wife and I went on a cruise down the Rhine, and we happened across an amazing village in Holland with a windmill, a whole series of windmills.
Uh-huh.
We went to visit one of these windmills, and it was turning slowly in the wind, grinding, and there was this dust everywhere. And I happened to find out it was a pigment grinding windmill, the only
wow.
one in the world.
Oh, my God.
And the guy who owns it goes all over the world every now and again, collects all these great rocks, and then brings them back to Holland to the windmill and grinds these amazing pigments. He said, "Do you want to see my inner sanctum?" I said, "Yes, please." And inside was this drawer upon drawer of packets of pigment.
Oh, incredible wow.
Incredible ochres and blues and reds, you know, like a dream. And so I bought a suitcase worth of these pigments. And then I found, well, how do I make those into paint? Well, I've then experimented with mixing raw pigment with modern alkyd resin media, which allow you to get a very fine and tough film. And that's how I began to develop the transparent pigment made. But I also use very high-quality oil, tube-made paints as well.
Uh-huh.
I did a lot of research, again, this is perhaps my scientific background, into the actual chemistry of the pigments and how best to make them work and how not to use them in combination in certain times. For instance, there is a very famous Rothko painting in the Tate in London, which the paint colours have begun to change because of the chemical interactions between two very distinctive pigments.
Wow.
So what Rothko intended is now not what we see. So there is an awful lot to the craft of painting that needs to be certainly taught and studied, and I did go into some depth studying that process.
That's your medical background.
Yeah.
He's studying chemistry as a painter.
Yes. And I try and use single pigments at any one time because, you know, it's easy to use combinations of pigments in tubes, you know, to get a certain effect. But if you use single pigments, then you mix them yourself, you can get better results.
Wow. I often wonder if when you're approaching a painting and you have colors in mind, is it ever really, really difficult to find the color that's in your head and create it on the canvas?
Well, I start completely unscripted.
Really?
So I'm very inspired by music. So I tend to listen to music when I paint. And I have a repertoire of these colors. And at any given painting I choose out of perhaps 50 or 60, I choose 4 or 5. And that's going to set the tone for the painting. So I have no idea what I'm going to paint.
I see. So you're never disappointed. You don't have a color in your head going,
no.
Gosh, I can't
no.
find that.
Interestingly enough, I have had some paintings which were shown in Miami, for instance, and the person who was in charge of them didn't look after them very well, and he damaged them.
Oh, no.
I was not pleased, of course, but I had to repair them. So I thought, how do I match the colors? And that's a tricky one, you know, to go back in and
repair. Have to repair
so
your own work.
It is possible, kind of, to get a close match, but I actually had to reinvent one or two of them.
Wow. Oh, how disappointing to see your work damaged.
Yes.
But perhaps the fates wanted the work to look.
Do you ever think of those terms? As things turn out. Yeah.
Many of your paintings look like seascapes. But,
yes.
You know, I mean, not seascapes that really exist. Are you going for that?
No, I think the earlier ones were definitely aquascapes. I would agree with that. But I think more recently, having spent a couple of toughish winters in New York State, I've become influenced by the kind of mountainous, wintry landscapes we've had here. And, of course, the waterfalls of this area are beautiful.
Uh-huh.
And I went up to Gannock, for instance, in winter and took some amazing photographs of the frozen ice, and the colour hues there were just astounding.
Yeah.
That spawned a whole series of paintings.
Yeah, a lot of your work also looks like it could be on some kind of other planetscape.
Yes, so
you
very
know?
Much. Somebody yeah. once said that one of the paintings which sold up in Penyan was like something out of Tolkien. You know?
Yeah, it is. Lord of the Rings some of those strange science fiction films. Yeah, you're going into the realm of science fiction.
Yes.
If you're just joining us, my guest is artist and painter Nicholas Down. So you said that when you sit down in front of a canvas, you don't have a deliberate idea. Do you ever, though? Because you say you go out and take pictures.
Mm.
Are you ever deliberately sitting down and trying to copy a scape?
Everything is a complete improvisation.
Really?
Yeah.
And do you ever sit in the open and paint?
I have done.
I've done a lot of drawing, in fact.
But technically, it's actually quite tricky taking oil paint out because of the drying time and so on. Watercolours are easier, but it's more a question of observation at the time, taking those impressions back to the studio, and then out comes the new work.
Wow.
I also improvise music at the piano, so it's a similar process. You know, you have no idea where the first note will lead.
Yeah. I always want to ask artists, how important is it for you to get praise from the public and from reviewers? And
well, a little bit of my story. In my previous marriage, I was soldering on doing the work. And I had no particular recognition at the time. When I met Judy, my wife, I decided to give her 12 paintings when she flew over from New York to visit me once, knowing perhaps it would be awkward for her to take them back, but they were on thin canvas boards at the time. And we sat down in the living room, and there were these 12 paintings. She was in tears. She couldn't believe how amazing. She said, "You are an artist." So that began a sense of recognition. Yeah. And she has really been totally instrumental in building my career with me, to help me build from nothing. I had my first solo show in 2001, and so it went on. And then I've exhibited all over the place, really. I've been very fortunate to have sold about 250 paintings.
Wow, that's amazing. I saw how many places in countries where people have bought your work.
Yeah.
So did you always long to be a practicing artist instead of a doctor? Was there always that?
I think I was always conflicted. I think certainly when I was doing my medical studies, you know, I was doing all the science, all the histopathology, the pharmacology and all that. I was inherently squeamish, so I could never have been a surgeon. That was always out of the question. And I think I did feel a tremendous sense of conflict, but once you're on that bandwagon, you can't get off.
Yeah, yeah. Did you feel like there was something inside you that needed to come out
in art and was being
bottled up?
Yeah, I think it's a struggle for expression. Going back to being a late teenager, beginning originally with poetry, I did write a few poems, wrote some music, and I began to realize there was something I definitely wanted to express.
Uh-huh.
Absolutely.
And so what did your family and friends think when you gave up medicine for this? A leap that they were...
I think they were delighted.
...extremely
were
freaked delighted. Out about, yeah. Really?
No. I mean, I retired at 55. It was a calculated decision, and I'm very, very glad I did. You know, I was very grateful for my work as a doctor. I looked after 3,000 patients on average over the years. I had two fabulous partners in my medical practice. And, you know, wonderful patients, and they gave me a tremendous send-off when I left.
Uh-huh.
I would have had to retire sometime. And I also read a statistic that GPs who retire at the age of 60 may live, perhaps on average, another 14 years. If you retire at 65, you've probably got another 2 years to live.
Oh, my gosh.
So it kind of makes you think.
So when you were practicing as a doctor, you were still doing art, though, in some sense,
well,
right?
Yes, from time to time. I mean, obviously, in the last 10 years, I was really busy exhibiting internationally. There was one time when we flew to New York about four or five times in the course of 6 months. And I was very fortunate at the time to have very supportive partners. You know, I took my leave every time I could to do it. So, yes, the last 10 years was very much working towards that.
You were doing both. Yeah. Now, your resume says you were the director of the Art Society at London Hospital Medical College, right?
Yes.
I've never heard of anything like that. Tell us what that is.
Well, we had lots of societies as students. I mean, there was a mountaineering society, a bridge club.
So this was like a club?
Yes. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. So I became a director. I organized two very successful group shows on the premises, and it was really very successful. That was why I was given the blue medal for my work.
Uh-huh. So that was a way for you to stay in touch, too, with the art.
Yes, very much so.
Do you think we'll ever see any of your medical experiences reflected in your art?
Not in my art, but hopefully in my writing. I think my book, which I'm polishing at the moment, that has a tremendous story to tell, and it's actually about the patients.
Uh-huh.
So, yes, I think it will.
And so we'll never see any of your medicine?
Not visually, I don't think so.
From your medical career?
Yeah.
Now, I've talked to a lot of artists who say that trying to talk about their work has been their biggest challenge, and it's really difficult, and we have to sit down and formulate a way to talk about our work. How has that been for you? In order to sell your work, I've been told you have to learn how to talk about it.
That's very true. I think you need to have the sort of lexicon or the language to express yourself. Barnett Newman was a case in point. He embarked on this incredible lecture series because his strip paintings were completely baffling people, and so he actually lectured and lectured and lectured, and gradually he got his views across. Jackson Pollock, on the other hand, he didn't really talk about it.
A lot of people don't want to talk about it.
No, he didn't. And in fact, you know, he hated being observed, and sadly, I think that process actually resulted in his death. But I think I'm fortunate enough to have some of the language that I can use, although it is tricky to find the right kind of words, because, again, you know, a picture's worth 1,000 words. I'd rather use a picture than words.
Yeah, yeah. So if somebody asked you, what kind of paintings do? You know how people ask that? What would you tell them?
Well, yes, again, is it a genre or idiom? Abstract impressionism is a word that comes to mind, I think. And the word biomorphic was very kindly offered to me by a critic called John Mendelsohn, who I met in New York in 2002.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
He talked about the word biomorphic drawing and so on. So that's a useful word. You know, it's kind of drawn from biology, from morphism, from drawing. And then you have abstract biomorphism, which is an abstracted version.
Uh-huh. What do you think you're trying to convey to people? And what, in fact, are you expressing from yourself that we should take from these paintings? Do you know?
I think in the abstract impressionist kind of abstracted landscapes, I think it's a reverence for landscape. I think absolutely I'm passionate about the great open spaces, you know, the national parks. I believe they need to be available to all the public.
Oh, absolutely.
And never to be in private hands, you know.
And that's what's happening in California right now, where I'm from, and they're trying to privatize the beach.
Oh, I know. I think once you start putting natural resources like that into private hands, you're on a slippery slope. And, of course, climate change, for whatever the cause, I think is a very grave threat to these places. I mean, I have yet to visit Glacier National Park, but while there are still some glaciers there, I want to go. But there, maybe in 20 years' time, there won't be.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm trying to communicate a sense of reverence and a sense for appreciation for these places. And I have a film which I made called America Sublime, which really gives a photographic interpretation of those places to reveal them.
Do you see things have already changed since you started painting landscapes? I mean, can you see climate change?
I haven't been very much to the north, to the far north. I mean, I know that the Arctic is really massively changing. Scotland, I think I did notice some changes over the years. And I've only been to the deserts two or three times. So I can't really... I mean, such change happens over decades, so it's hard for any one individual to notice. Although things like the very few monarch butterflies this year.
Yeah. I mean, everybody talks about that.
Four or five. I mean, what? Four or five?
Yeah. So a reverence for nature is certainly something that should be on all of our agendas.
Yeah.
I do wonder also, how did the move to the United States, the permanent move, change you as an artist? Did it?
Oh,
from London.
I was absolutely thrilled to be here. And again, I think I felt utterly at home. And then being in this vast landscape just kind of released the sense of expression, kind of uncorked the bottle a bit more.
Uh-huh. Did it change you as a person and therefore change you as an artist?
I think my wife would say I'm slightly bonkers.
but it seems to me just the change of retiring from being a physician would free you up.
Absolutely. I think one has to admire what doctors do, the sense of what they carry, the responsibility, but I have to say that being released from that responsibility was an incredible weight off my shoulders.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Because I was going to ask you if you have any regrets about leaving medicine and leaving your country, country.
Well, funnily enough, I never felt England was my country. I feel absolutely that this country is. But maybe it's because I was born overseas in Africa. But I don't have any regrets at all. I mean, I'm very, very grateful for what it gave me and for the experience I had. I have so much gratitude for the encounters I had with patients. I think it does teach you an awful lot when you experience people's lives.
See
children grow up to become adults, adults to become old people, and the whole transitions of the human story, really. And I think there's an amazing appreciation for that.
Uh-huh. Do you think you would be happy as a painter if your work hadn't started selling, if you were just sitting in a little room and canvases were stacking up and nobody was buying them? How do you think you'd feel?
I have to be really honest that the sales have been a tremendous gratification, and the appreciation I've had from observers, critics, and so on. I have to say that's been an amazing boost.
Yeah, it probably keeps you going, right?
I could have carried on in the metaphorical garret, but I would have probably ended up like the beautiful mind, you know, just with nothing and, you know,
just spinning around.
Yes.
What do you say to people who say they might want to take up painting like later in life or just in general? How do you inspire?
Absolutely, go for it. There is a very interesting psychological text called On Not Being Able to Paint, which for anybody struggling with this, I would recommend they read. But in any case, give it a go. I think one has to learn to express yourself. Loosen up. Go for big brushes, not small ones. Learn to draw first and then paint.
Learn to draw first and then paint. Do you recommend people take classes and actually formally study?
Yeah, well, yes. I think this is always an interesting dilemma as to whether, you know, the whole concept of going to art school is, you know, what it should be. In Italy, for instance, an art school teaches you the craft of painting.
Mm.
And the painters there are really taught in the way of the old masters. They really know how to do their stuff. You know, controversially, a lot of the art schools in England go for conceptual approaches to work. So they tend to throw the craft out the window and try and encourage the conceptual approach, which of course spawned a whole brigade of young Brit artists in the 90s, Damien Hirst, for instance.
Oh, yeah. What? You know, go ahead.
He fashioned a diamond-encrusted skull, of course, which was...
What modern artists have inspired you, actually? Living artists? Are there any?
I have to say I'm probably pretty much a modernist rather than a postmodernist. So I would say that, you know, I was very much inculcated with the world of Picasso, Clay, Miro.
Yeah, me too. I like the Impressionists too.
I would probably have to do some homework on that.
I wonder if you're in any way influenced by Edward Hopper, who's such an American identified painter.
I totally love his work. I think it's very filmic. It's kind of absolutely is right up there with the whole filmmaking process for me.
So really modern. Mm. It looks too modern to you, probably. How has it been being on the art trail? I know you're part of the art trail.
Very grateful to it. I mean, I think I'm, for instance, open to the public this weekend. I was open to the public last weekend. Tremendous opportunities have come from this. I've been offered a solo show at the Beard Gallery in Cornwall in January.
Wow.
I was offered a show at Pen Yan in June. And a number of things have come out of it, quite a few sales as well. So it's been very good. I'm very grateful, of course, to the organisers of the Art Trail, Robin Schwartz and so on.
Oh, yeah. I love the Art Trail. Yeah. I love being able to go to people's... That's what I loved about Amsterdam, too.
Yes, yeah.
They'd have people in their houses on certain days. You'd go down the street and people would be offering you wine. Now, tell us about any future work. Are you working on any series? What's happening in the future?
I've got two very large pieces in my studio at the moment, which are a blank. And they are probably 6 foot by 4.
Wow.
And I've had to construct a little bit of engineering on my painting wall to be able to accommodate them. I haven't started those. They are going to be two paintings. Of course, I have no idea what I'm going to do, but we shall see.
I was going to say, is Nicholas suddenly coming up with concepts
instead of
just sitting and not knowing?
No. It'll be very much an invention.
But you decided what size you wanted to paint.
Yeah, well, yes, I did. I've also... done. My most recent painting is actually called Glacial Awakening. It's actually 4 foot by 5, I think. But that's all about awakening our notions to the perils of glacial melting.
Yeah, and where can people see some of your work? Is it permanently hanging anywhere?
I'm very fortunate. In my home, in my studio, I have actually a gallery downstairs with 3 exhibition spaces. So there, I've got 28 paintings on show there.
Wow. Okay.
There's a painting at the SOAG Gallery in State Street.
I saw that, actually, after I invited you on. Yeah.
And then there's going to be a show at Welcome Home Cinema Showroom in Rochester at the end of the month on the 26th of October. I've got 12 paintings there.
Great. Well, Nicholas Down, we're almost out of time. Can you give people contact information?
Yes. If you Google me, Nicholas Down, I probably come up on the first page in the first 4 or 5. My website is nicholasdown.net, and my email is nacd@mac.com.
Great. Mm-hmm. Well, Nicholas Down, thank you so much for joining us. Again, my guest has been the painter Nicholas Down. Keep up the great work. It's beautiful stuff. Thank you, Tish. Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.